I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Join me on a quest to find awe and wonder in all nature, human or wild, vast or small, encounters with creation that move us beyond words. Your host for this episode is Constant Wonder producer Eric Schultzke.
Transparent, usually less than 1 millimeter long, nematodes or nematodes, take your pick, are ubiquitous in the soil under your feet. Some are plant parasites, some range freely, eating fungus, bacteria, and other tiny things. Others, despite their diminutive size, are fierce predators.
Here you have this parasitic worm. It's moving around. It's looking for an insect to infect. It finds one. It crawls into it through natural openings, liquefies the interior of it, turns it into like an insect milkshake, and then begins to multiply. And soon what started out as like 10 or maybe 100 of these nematodes at the beginning, now you have tens of thousands of nematodes coming out of it, and they're all looking for new insects to infect. I grew up loving James Cameron movies, Ridley Scott movies.
Just tell me one thing, Burke. You're going out there to destroy them, right? Not to study, not to bring back, but to wipe them out.
That's the plan.
To me, that was like, this could be, you know, the next big movie that James Cameron does. It was fascinating. I couldn't believe there was something on the planet that lives that way. I was hooked.
Given his unusual passion, you won't be surprised to learn that Adler Dillman is a professor of nematology at the University of California, Riverside. We sometimes describe people as having contagious enthusiasm. Dillman certainly has that. And he was infected as an undergraduate through social contact with one of his college professors. And so when Dillman recently discovered a new insect-ravaging species of nematode, he knew immediately who he should name it after.
Steinernema adamsi, after Byron Adams. He's the one that introduced me to him, and it just seemed like such a fitting tribute.
2 decades ago, Adler Dillman was a lowly college sophomore when he first met Byron Adams, who at that time was himself a brand new biology professor at Brigham Young University.
I was waiting in the hallway to speak with my counselor about, should I take these two physics classes or these statistics classes to satisfy a requirement? And Byron was walking down the hallway and said, hey, what are you doing? And I showed him the paper, and he started talking to me, and he said, well, are you interested in doing research? And I said, yeah, I'm really interested in doing research. And he said, well, I'm new. We're having my first lab meeting next week on Monday. Do you want to be there? So I was there. I'd never heard of a nematode in my life. And Byron introduced me to this wonderful world underfoot that has become my passion. It's become what I think about at night, what I think about on weekends. So I started it as an undergrad, and here I am 9 years into being a faculty member, and it's still my passion, my obsession, and I love it.
Now, if your passion is nematodes, I've got good news for you. You'll never run out of them. Nematodes are the most numerous multicellular critters on Earth. For each human being on Earth, there are 57 billion of these little roundworms. Nematodes have become rock stars in genetic research, with huge implications for humans in biomedicine. But what really got us going on the topic was the nematologists themselves. Admittedly, our sample size isn't huge, but from what we can see, this seems to be a field that is crackling with an expectation of discovery and a delight in the unknown. Perpetual surprise, that's what the great theologian Abraham Heschel called it. See, it's one thing to know that the universe is a vast and unimaginably complex place. It is quite another to take delight at every turn, seeing the world as though you were seeing it for the first time. And they have good reason to be open to surprise, because in this phylum of nematodes, there may yet be millions, if not many millions, of undiscovered species. In short, whatever it is that the nematodes are digesting, nematologists feed on surprise and amazement in a quest to understand these little worms. Here at Constant Wonder, we thought we'd just take a tour, paint a collage of nematodes and nematology in hopes that maybe just a little of that perspective rubs off on the rest of us in our daily lives. In a moment, we'll be speaking with both Adler Dillman and Byron Adams, but before we get there, I needed to clarify a very important question, which I posed to Byron on a visit to his lab. Nematode or nematode?
Yeah, is there some people that really feel strongly about how to pronounce that term? They really think it should be pronounced nematode. And so when I'm hanging out with them, I kind of intentionally always just say nematode, just because I don't think it's fair to say that you own how to pronounce that term. I say nematode when I'm talking to people on the West Coast, and I say nematode when I talk to them on the East Coast, because the people on the East Coast just irritates them if you pronounce it that way. People on the West Coast are a little bit cooler about it.
Okay, I'm so glad that we got that straightened out. Now, having heard how Adler got involved in nematodes through social contact with the infectious enthusiasm of Byron Adams, I wanted to find out Byron's story, what his initiation into nematodes was. It turns out that this was a serendipity that came about because he and his wife, Marcy, were both trying to find a single graduate institution that could serve both of their professional needs.
She's a herpetologist, and I was interested in invertebrates. And we were trying to find a place where we could both do graduate work, and there were zero. And she really wanted to go to the University of Nebraska because they had the greatest herpetology, reproductive ecology, kind of behavioral ecology program there. There was another faculty member out there who was awesome. And I was like, fine, I'll work in John's lab. And so I started working in his lab on toads. I was studying toads of North America, their evolutionary history and their biogeography. So that was the first start. Toads, like T-O-A-D-S, like the amphibians, like those things. And then before long, he was like just permanently in Columbia and not there to be my advisor. And there was another lab on campus who I'd already been talking with regularly. And he was like, yo, dude, just come do stuff in my lab. We got all this cool stuff going on. And so I was like, right on. I started with toads and I ended up with nematodes.
There you go.
And so having made the leap from toads to nematodes, Byron Adams never looked back.
One of the things I love about them is that they were some of the first animal lineages to ever evolve on the planet. So they've been around for a long time. And they filled every single niche on the planet. So at every place on the planet that life can exist, they pretty much do exist. They are just so abundant and numerous and diverse on our planet. And the other thing I love about them is that they are animals. They're like us. You know, they got a mouth, they got an anus, they got an intestine, they got reproductive systems and things like that. A lot of the genes that they have, like basic functional genes that are involved in things like growth and behavior and reproduction, like we have the very same genes that they have. So they're a really great animal model. And like you could study birds and chimps and stuff like that. But if you wanted to start doing experiments on them, like, you know, I don't know, lighting them on fire or like freezing them or smashing them and taking their DNA, people get really upset, right? You do that with a dog or a cat or something. But with nematode worms, like nobody cares, right? They're like, you can smash those all you want.
Why do you want to be so mean to the nematodes? Because when you say it like that, it sounds like you're just a sadist.
Yeah. It sounds like I'm a mean guy, but the reality is that I'm incredibly curious because I've seen whatever it is that we're doing to them happen to them, like in the real world. Like I've seen them dry to a crisp. I've seen them being frozen in a block of ice. I've seen them get like blasted with UV radiation, right? So what I want to do is I just want to do that to them, like the experience in the natural world, but I want to do it in a way so that I can figure out how they survive that.
And that actually has implications for medical research, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's some biomedical research implications for this because the animals are able to go into suspended animation for 40,000 years. And so if you think about biomedical applications, that'll include things like, hey, can we make freeze-dried blood, like blood that you can sit on the shelf that could be your very own? And you just, you know, mix it up with some of the chemicals that these nematodes use in order to do the same trick. And then all of a sudden, you've got a product that used to have a very short shelf life, now has a really long shelf life. Being able to survive what we would call like anhydrobiosis or life without water. Similarly, life is just frozen in a brick of ice like these nematodes were. If you could get organs for organ transplant, if you could just keep them frozen in a freezer for a while and then transplant them into human when the human's ready, like you could save a lot more human lives if you could do that. Because right now, one of the limiting factors for organ transplants is how long the organ is viable.
I think one reason there is so much energy in this field is that there is still so much to learn about it, and really so little that we know. No one knows for sure how many unique, unnamed nematodes are still out there. But let's just say that Steiner-Nema adamsi didn't really narrow that list by much. The next species discovered could offer exciting pathways ranging from biomedical to pest control. Here's Byron Adams.
Right now, there's between like 30 and 45,000 described species of nematodes and like hundreds of thousands of described insects. When I was in grad school, I just looked at the rates of differences of change in nematodes, and I extrapolated and showed that there's like between 1 and 100 million nematode species that are still yet to be described.
So is that generally understood then, that that's a good ballpark for how many are yet?
No, that's a debate. Like if someone were to listen to this show, they'd call in like right now and say, I don't believe it. There's probably only 45 or 50,000 species of nematodes, and that's right. All.
Millions of species we still haven't found? That left me wondering not only how old these various species might be, but how rapidly they might be evolving. How long had Steiner-Nema adamsi been waiting for Adler Dillman to find it?
Boy, that's a really good question. I don't have a good handle on that right now. That maybe could be our next research project. If I had to ballpark, just guess, based on the DNA work we have done, maybe 40 million years?
So then I asked Dillman about what these nematodes eat when they aren't making milkshakes out of insect guts. This actually resulted in an eye-opening exchange between Adams and Dillman about nematodes' superpowers. To keep the voices separate, just note that Adams is the one who uses the surfer language, and you sent me the video, dude.
They eat everything. It depends on which species of nematode you're talking about. That's one of the things I love about them. As Byron mentioned earlier, they've evolved to occupy virtually every niche imaginable. I haven't seen any flying nematodes yet. That might be the only one that I can think of that they don't actively inhabit.
Well, I actually have seen flying nematodes, Adler, and you sent me the video, dude.
They can jump, and it's a very impressive jump.
Oh, really?
And they can, yes.
Whoa, that's cool. Now we're talking about their muscles and nerves, right?
Right. They can jump, and they're like Olympian-quality jumpers. And when they jump, they rotate end over end. I mean, like somersault. They can jump like 10 times their body length height, right? So they jump 9, 10 millimeters high, and they're only 1 millimeter maybe in length. Only certain species are capable of doing that jump, but it's really fascinating, and we think it may be involved both in their ability to disperse in the environment, but also maybe as a host-seeking behavior to attach to passing insects.
Oh, like a flea jumping on a dog.
That's right.
How big are these things that are jumping? This is not visible to the naked eye. This is microscope jumping?
That's right. The ones that we've looked at, it turns out there seems to be a length limit to how long the worm can be and still be capable of jumping. So the ones that can do it really well are maybe around 700 microns, so less than a millimeter in length.
You got to send him the video, Adler. Once he sees the video, he'll be a believer.
And so, yes, he sent me the video, and yes, I am a believer. These are not hops. These are mammoth leaps. With full points for artistry. I'll go further. I'll say that these leaps border on superpower. Imagine a human leaping 50 to 60 feet vertically in the air, and then pity the poor insect who happens to walk by one of these leaping Nemos at the wrong time. Adler Dillman discovered that new species really by chance in his lab. He wasn't out looking for it. It kind of came to him.
We look for these beneficial nematodes. So the way that you typically look for them is you get a handful of soil and you put it in a small Tupperware, and then you put a few caterpillars in there. This is back at the lab. And then a few days later, you open it up and you see if any of the caterpillars died, and then you can take the caterpillars out and put them in a little petri dish with water, and sometimes nematodes will come out. So we had asked this colleague in Thailand to send us three particular species. He went ahead and sent us those. We work with the genus Steiner-Nema, and there's about 110 or so described species, and we're trying to do some of the genomic work. I'm always asking my colleagues for different species. Now, I learned when I was in Byron's lab that anytime somebody sends you a nematode, you have to do your own DNA work to make sure that it is what they say it is. We had ordered some beneficial nematodes in Byron's lab from a company, and they sent us the wrong one. It took us a few weeks to figure that out after we had done experiments with it. So when our colleagues in Thailand sent us their nematodes, we did our due diligence. We mashed them up and sequenced some of the DNA. And one of the species they had sent us was not what it was labeled as. It was actually a species that had not yet been described. It was different from all of the sequences in the database. So I reached out to them and asked if they would want to collaborate with us in describing it. We're always excited to get new species of insect parasitic nematodes because they might have new properties. They might thrive in particular climates. They might infect certain kinds of insects better.
The first thing Adler did after discovering that species was to get a population of them rolling in the lab.
When they send them to us, they send us a tube with like a couple million in there, but they're all the same species. They've come out of one infection, right? And so we had a few million of them. We, of course, start our own infection the minute that we get them. I mean, you expose caterpillars to them and then the caterpillars get infected and a week later you get tens of thousands of nematodes out of it.
Apparently, you could do this at home.
We use caterpillars that you can buy from like Petco. We use this thing called Galeria melanella. In the pet shop, they call it waxworm larvae. They're just little white grubs, little white caterpillars, and they serve as an excellent host. My lab must go through 2,000 to 4,000 of those grubs a month. We're growing a lot of worms.
You may already be familiar with the use of beneficial nematodes in the garden or in agriculture. They're very much in vogue these days. You can get them online by the millions, or you can get them from a nursery or a hardware store.
Ask for beneficial nematodes at an independent garden center near you, along with our full line of other beneficial insects.
And YouTube will teach you how to use them.
Good morning, garden nerds. I'm Christy Wilhelmi. It's Sunday morning at dawn, which is the time to apply beneficial nematodes to your garden.
And this following description should sound disturbingly familiar by now.
These nematodes that we have here are going to be going after the grubs that are predated by things like Japanese beetle, European chafer, and June bugs. They actually go out, seek and destroy and eat the grubs from the inside out, kind of like Alien. When you get the package, you're actually going to be buying yourself 10 million of them.
Dillman's professional life is pretty sweet. He loves space alien movies, he loves worms that act like space aliens, and the ones who can jump. And when his worms make insect milkshakes, well, they're doing us all a favor, and as long as we close our eyes to the details, they can even seem cuddly. But what if your professional lot in life is to study destructive nematodes, plant parasites that leave ruin in their wake? Well, you just might burst out in song.
The holly and the ivy, when they are both in flower, send out juicy little feeder roots that the nematodes devour.
The lyrics here are from the Plant Parasitic Nematode Songbook by the late Kathy Merrifield, who was a researcher at Oregon State University. So it appears to be possible to develop some measure of affection, even for destructive nematodes, like the Meloidogyne, that ravage the roots of your vegetable garden.
Meloidogyne, I long to kill you. You have ruined my tomatoes. No salsa and no ceviche. Bad roots, I've got bad roots, cursed with swollen root knot.
And here's a catalog of nematode pests that, well, you can imagine Maria von Trapp falling in love with.
Spiral on radish and ring on tomato, lesion on mint and root knot on potato, stem and bulb climbing up maidenhair ferns. These are a few of my favorite worms. Dagger on woody plants, seed gall on grasses, second stage juveniles forming wool masses, stubby root vectoring cork earring germs. These are a few of my favorite worms. When the stem wilts, when the leaf burns, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite worms, and then I don't feel so bad.
Adler, any thoughts?
Nice. Whoever wrote that is a very good lyricist and knows their nematodes well.
Okay.
No, so what they're describing is the phenotype that's become associated with a disease. So lesion, there is a nematode that they call lesion nematode, and that's not its name, but that's what it does to plants. It causes lesions.
Right. And stem and bulb climbing up maidenhair ferns.
Yes. So this is going to be a nematode actually that someone in our department is looking at right now. It causes a gall on ferns that looks like a bulb on the plant, and it climbs up the stem of the fern in order to induce that phenotype.
Second stage juveniles forming wool masses.
Yeah, that's exactly what they do. And I'm telling you, these songs, I'm sure, have all been vetted by John Eisenbach, and he's an expert. I mean, he knows his business. They give you good visuals there, along with that playful language.
John Eisenbach is a leading nematologist at Virginia Tech University. And yes, he did have a hand in popularizing the plant parasitic nematode songbook. I can't help but think that these goofy lyrics and this good humor are just another reflection of that openness to surprise and that willingness to be delighted that seems to characterize the field of nematology as a whole. I think there may be time for one more verse.
The autumn worms drift through my soil sieve. The autumn worms I've tried to hold. I dream of data and hope they're living. Although right now they are wet and cold. But then the screen goes dark. It's filled with mud. The worms are hidden in icky crud. Oh, I'm missing data points from summer when autumn worms start to crawl.
You are listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke.
I want to take a moment and recommend another show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts, The Lisa Show. With life's great onslaught, everything that can overwhelm us and add stress to our life, Lisa Valentine Clark, her guests, and Council of Moms provide a practical, positive outlook on our ongoing daily challenges. They tackle problems head-on with wisdom and experience. You'll hear suggestions for better handling interpersonal relationships, useful ideas related to health, technology, body image, family, and a host of other important issues. It's called The Lisa Show, and of course, it's available wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder.
For all of the virtuosity that we've seen in these nematodes, all of the complexity that we've seen in them, we are talking about an incredibly simple organism. 302 neurons. Compare that to the 70 million neurons in a mouse, or to the 86 billion neurons in a human being. This complexity, packaged in simplicity, makes nematodes valuable for scientific research. It's time now to consider a certain nematode whose proper name is C. elegans, but I'm told that in the community it is known simply as the worm. Adler, you're the first one who told me that it's known as the worm. So why don't you go ahead and talk to us a little bit about the worm?
In biology, we have a number of model systems. These are organisms that we study that have conserved biology with humans and with other animals and life on the planet. And we use them as models to understand how biology works. So there's a very famous plant model, Arabidopsis thaliana. People study that to understand plants in general and biology in general. C. elegans is the model multicellular animal. And we've learned so much about how biology works through this particular worm. It was developed as a model system by scientists that were interested in studying the neurobiology of behavior. So they wanted to understand how the brain is connected to behavior, but they needed something simpler than a mouse, something simpler than a fruit fly. Because when you look at the number of neurons those organisms have and the number of connections those neurons have, it's a very daunting task. C. elegans itself only has 302 neurons. We know exactly where all of those neurons are positioned in its head. We know all of the connections that those neurons make. So it's a very good model for understanding how a brain can control behavior. And even though it is a nematode worm, some people might say, well, then what kind of behaviors could it possibly have? It's capable of some pretty sophisticated behavior, and there are really cool studies showing that they can learn too.
All right, talk to me about learning.
They can learn to avoid certain types of food. So if they're presented with bacteria that's not good or that is pathogenic, they can learn to avoid bacteria that's pathogenic.
They're going, that tasted yucky, I'm not going to try that again.
Presumably, yeah. Yeah.
That's a good
skill.
Which
is really cool. As I mentioned earlier, they're also capable of jumping.
Yeah.
They also have mating behavior, and a lot of work's been done on that. They can avoid pain, so they're able to detect pain. When you put them on a petri dish with agar and you expose them to a chemical called octanol, they withdraw very quickly, and we can actually measure that. And so people have done studies on cannabis and cannabis-like molecules, and they can show that C. elegans has a endocannabinoid receptor. It can detect these molecules.
Does
and when
it like
it's
it?
On a, I don't know if it likes it, but its ability to detect pain is reduced when it's on these
Whoa.
Substances. Yeah.
When I was a kid, fruit flies were the things. Like, oh, yeah, fruit flies. But C. elegans has really kind of displaced the fruit fly. In many respects?
I wouldn't say it's displaced. It's another useful model. So there's some advantages. I actually work with fruit flies in my lab also, and C. elegans, the generation time is much faster. If you want to work with fruit flies, from egg to adult, it's like 14 days. That's a short generation time. But if you look at C. elegans, egg to adult is 3 days.
Whoa.
So in the time you have one generation of fruit flies, right, you can have 5 generations of nematodes.
Right, and they're transparent, right?
Naturally transparent,
so
you can see all the
yeah.
cells. They also have a smaller genome, which is quite helpful. It's about a third the size of the Drosophila genome, the mm-hmm. fruit fly genome. So it was easier, using the technology we had then, it was easier to assemble and sequence the C. elegans genome, but it has all the same components. We can learn a lot about genomes in general and genome architecture from studying the genome of C. elegans. It's actually the first multicellular animal to have its genome sequenced, and I think arguably it still is the genome that we have the best understanding of any animal on planet Earth.
The proof is in the prizes. In 2002, the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine went to 3 researchers for discovering the genes that pre-program the death of certain cells as a routine function. As I understand it, this led directly to the discovery of parallel genes in humans. Now, this is important because hastening the death of a cell that would otherwise die of its own later, but more disruptively, could preempt or limit the collateral damage to surrounding cells, thereby reducing the risks of aging or cancer. Then in 2006, the Nobel Prize went to researchers who worked with C. elegans again to figure out how to silence certain gene expressions by inserting altered RNA into a cell. The Nobel Committee wrote that the ability to interfere with certain gene expressions may open numerous therapies for cancer, genetic disorders, viral infections, and more. Humans like winning prizes, but sheer survival is the nematode's greatest reward. And in almost any environment and over incredibly long periods of time, nematodes are found existing, persisting. If anyone ever offers to bet you that they have found a spot on Earth that is devoid of nematodes, take the odds.
2020, COVID pandemic, there were restrictions on being in the lab. So I was doing a lot of hiking. And I saw this sign on Antelope Island that said only brine flies and brine shrimp can live in the hypersaline waters of the Great Salt Lake.
That's Michael Werner, a molecular biologist at the University of Utah. Werner studies nematodes to learn more about why and how certain genes are expressed or suppressed. That makes him at least an honorary nematologist, and he certainly has the nematologist's fondness for surprise and delight.
And the reason I was skeptical is because of the amazing work that people have been doing where they found nematodes in incredible places and other extreme environments, including the McMurdo Dry Valleys of Antarctica, which is Byron's work, so the driest, coldest place on the planet. And there were some other high-profile papers in the 2010s finding worms miles below the surface in an abandoned gold mine. We have to mention this incredible story that came out recently. I think it was a German group. They found a worm in the permafrost in the Siberian tundra, and they thawed the ice. The worm reanimated, was alive. They were able to culture it on plates. They radiocarbon dated the ice. It was 30 to 40,000 years old, meaning that worm has been alive in a dormant state for that long. They're an incredible animal phylum. They're so interesting in their own right. And all of those things made me want to look more carefully to see if there was any mention of nematodes living there.
So there stood Michael Werner on Antelope Island in the Great Salt Lake in 2020, staring at a sign. That sign left no wiggle room on the question of aquatic life below the surface of those waters. The blanket assertion was that if you're looking for a living animal in this lake, it's going to be either a brine shrimp or a brine fly. So Michael started asking around, and one of the first people he asked was Byron Adams, who told him that even though he had lived in the area for 20 years, he had actually failed in his first and only attempt to find nematodes in the lake.
When I moved here, like the first thing I did was like, oh yeah, I'm going to jump on this, right? And I skipped the south side of the lake and went straight up to the north end where it was like really weird and really saline. And I was interested in these petroleum seeps that made microbes that could eat the petroleum. And I wanted to find worms that could live on those. And I sampled the heck out of that whole place up there and I didn't find any nematodes. And so when Michael asked, hey, have you ever sampled down there? Oh yeah, I sampled all over the lake. I never found anything alive, right?
And so with the encouragement of people like Byron Adams and others, Michael Werner and his assistants set out to do their own muck sampling. After collecting their samples, they tried to extract the worms using a standard method that involves a funnel, water, some finger crossing, but there were no worms.
We thought, well, maybe they are truly not there and the sign was right. But I knew that Byron Adams down the road at BYU recovers nematodes from the Antarctic McMurdo Dry Valleys, which are an incredible place to find nematodes. And so I simply asked him, how do you do it? Byron was incredibly gracious and invited me to up to his lab to watch his method.
So here's how that method basically works. You mix and filter silt and debris over and over again using a series of sieves and filters. The separated liquid goes into a centrifuge. You give it a spin, you rinse and repeat, and this time you use a secret ingredient, which we're going to disclose later.
Now you have mostly just nematodes on top of that filter, and then you can backwash them into a petri dish and then look at the petri dish to see if you find any nematodes there. And when we did that, then we started to find 5 nematodes, 4 nematodes, 1 nematode, and that was amazing to us. We were totally stoked to finally see worms out there. And immediately I knew this was going to be a cool story.
Now they had their nematodes, but only handfuls of them. They wanted worms by the bucketful. And that's when the next surprise came, thanks to Michael's postdoc assistant, Julie Jung. Before we get to that scene, though, we have to introduce a wondrous rock system in the Great Salt Lake, mineral clusters built by bacteria. They're not unlike coral reefs. They're called microbolites. And here's Michael explaining how they work.
So a microbiolite is actually a rock built by bacteria. There are models about how this works, but it's not entirely known. So over time, the bacterial layers calcify and lithify, and then a next layer forms on top of it. And then that calcifies and lithifies, and then another layer forms on top of it. And that's how you grow this sort of small nucleus towards a pretty large, very visible structure. The surface of these rocks are cyanobacteria, which are photosynthetic bacteria, and algae, other photosynthetic organisms, that receive sunlight and then turn that into carbon. And they serve as the food source for other invertebrates, primarily brine fly larvae. And brine fly larvae, of course, are a major food source for some of the resident and migratory birds. These microbialites are extremely important for the whole ecosystem.
So now with a basic understanding of how microbialites work, we're ready for the next big surprise.
My postdoc, Julie June, came in and she said, Michael, I think they might be in the microbialites, referring to the nematodes. And I sat back in my chair and I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Yeah, let's think about that. And in my mind, this was something that we might develop over like several months. But about 2 minutes later, I heard this like very loud banging happening in the lab, and I was a little worried. And so I ran out, and there was Julie with a hammer smashing the microbialite to pieces. She then took that sediment and filtered that through the same process that Byron taught us how to do. And that's when we recovered hundreds, thousands of nematodes. If you sample next to the microbialite, then you might find 4 or 5. If you sample within the microbialite, then it's, again, hundreds or thousands.
Are they living embedded in these layers that are accreted?
Yes. We have to do a little bit more research, but we think they're not really on the surface per se, but actually inside of the microbialites.
So evidently then there's enough in these layers, there's enough space for them to exist. They don't need a lot, but there's enough space.
That's what we think, yes. There's a couple of gaps in our knowledge about how they form, and it could be that the burrowing through the sediment, transporting minerals and carbonate and bacteria throughout the microbialite could actually be involved in building it. To be determined, but an exciting future direction.
Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. In this episode, we're bringing you a collage from the wild world of nematodes and nematology in hopes that some of us may get infected with their enthusiasm. If not about nematodes, maybe about life in general. We're being guided here by 3 experts, Adler Dillman of UC Riverside, Byron Adams from BYU, and we've been joined now by Michael Werner from the University of Utah. We're headed next to Byron Adams' lab for a little more clarity on his trick of spinning worms out of muck. I have almost never set foot in a biology research lab. So when Elaine Scott, one of our Constant Wonder student producers, and I got the chance to go hang out with Byron Adams in his lab, it was a real treat.
We're in the life science building at Brigham Young University in what we call the Molecular Clean Laboratory. In this room, we have a series of refrigerators and freezers. This is where we'll keep our working stock samples, like the ones that go from here to the bench and back to here and back to the bench. We also have long-term storage freezers where we keep our samples. We have the largest collection in the world of frozen Antarctic soil samples. So they're incredibly valuable. Like, they're like gold. We treat them like gold. And the organisms that are in them are alive. So we can keep things in the freezer for who knows how long. I've got stuff from the 1980s that you just open it up and thaw it out, and these animals come back alive again, right? And so as long as you keep them frozen, then we have a snapshot, and we can thaw it out, and we can do an experiment, and that experiment will represent what life was like in 1987 in Taylor Valley, Antarctica. These are samples that my students are currently working with. So they're not frozen. They're thawed out.
From the freezers, the soil is taken to another lab, a less clean lab, where the microscopic worms are extracted from the soil by spinning them in the secret ingredient I mentioned earlier, which turns out to be sugar water.
This is where things get dirty here. So in this lab, this is the centrifuge that we use to spin the nematodes and this dirt and separate the dirt slash soil, rocks, roots, whatever. We separate them from the nematodes. And so we use a procedure called density gradient centrifugation. We mix the soil up with sugar, and the sugar has the same specific gravity as a nematode. And when you spin it, all the rocks and dirt go to the bottom of the tube, and the nematodes float up to the top of the tube. And that way we can separate the nematodes from the soil, put them in a dish, and have like a really nice clean look at the animals that live in the soil.
How do you get the sugar out?
Yeah, so we rinse the sugar water with the nematodes over a sieve using some clean water, and I'll show you that. This is an example of a set of sieves that we would use to extract animals from the soil. So we would mix the animals up in a tube with some water spin it all up, mix it up, pour the water and the soil over the top of this set of strainers. And the animals are small enough that they'll pass through that sieve. They'll pass through that and they'll land on that sieve. This sieve will catch all the big rocks and gunk and stuff like that. There's a lot of small rocks and gunk that can pass through too. So on this sieve, you'll have a bunch of small rocks, silt, gunk, and nematodes, tardigrades, rotifers, microscopic animals. Then we take the stuff that falls off of this, we put it in another test tube, and we spin it. Everything goes to the bottom of that tube. Animals, dirt, yuck. Then we pour the water off of the top of that one. We pour the sugar on top of that. Mm-hmm. Then resuspend it all, stir it all up. So now everything that was in that tube is just in sugar water. Then we put that tube in the centrifuge, spin it again, dirt goes to the bottom, worms go to the top. Then we pour the worms over this fine screen. And this one, the animals will stay on top. All the sugar water will pass through, and we rinse it with clean water. And now we can resuspend these live animals in a dish or a tube that's got all of our animals in it with just clean water. So you get a really good look at them.
Byron next showed us a room full of little incubators used to either keep the worms happy or stress them out.
In this room with these incubators, we can set them so that they'll freeze, so that they'll warm up, that they'll cycle with lights on and off. Mm. And we use that to usually try and keep the animals happy, but we can also use that to stress them. We can desiccate them, we can dry them to a crisp, we can freeze dry them.
Finally, we came to a glassed-in, walk-in refrigerator room set up to replicate a really nice summer day in Antarctica.
So this is a walk-in climate-controlled chamber. We can control the light cycle in there. We can also control the temperature. Right now, it's set for like the warmest day ever in Taylor Valley, Antarctica. People think that Antarctic animals must like it freezing cold and dark and dry. No, they can tolerate it, but they hate it, right? So we've discovered that they really like being at about 16 degrees Celsius with full sun. Yeah, that's like their beach day. Like, what is that, 60, 65 degrees? Here, let's go in. You can feel it.
Oh, my.
I would be a happy bug in here.
Yeah. I mean, you might want a sweater, but other than that, you'd be good. So what you see on these plates here is our attempts to grow moss, algae, cyanobacteria from Antarctica, and also organisms like nematodes and rotifers and tardigrades.
This is an Antarctic nursery we're in.
Yeah, this is like an Antarctic nursery, sure, yeah.
So what we're looking at here is Petri dishes, and they look like they've got brown and green scum. It looks kind of like what you see in a fish tank that had been neglected.
Yeah, to be fair, these are things that have been neglected. So if you were to look at the dates on them, this was from 2018, so that dish has been like that, sealed up in there since 2018. And you can see what's grown in there. We're growing some moss and some algae. Some of it's actually got old enough that it's starting to die and form some organic substrate. Yeah, this is an attempt to grow stuff from Antarctica.
So that particular dish has been sitting there for about 6 years at the same temperature in this room?
Same temperature, same conditions, constant.
From the Antarctic to your backyard, these microscopic worms are everywhere under feet. You'd have to work very hard to avoid nematodes. And as we'll hear next, that's probably not a good idea.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast from BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry, host of In Good Faith, an interfaith podcast committed to listening as believers of many traditions share their personal experience with the sacred and the divine. And we've just dropped our 200th episode. Why not take a moment to check out In Good Faith at byuradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts? I think you'll be inspired by our amazing guests sharing first-person accounts of the power of faith and belief on the In Good Faith podcast.
Adler Dillman's nematodes are classed as beneficials because they keep certain insect populations in check. But it may be time to start thinking more broadly about what that term beneficial means. We may be finding that keeping our living environment sterile is a bad idea, and that maybe allergies, autoimmune disorders, and other susceptibilities often stem from keeping ourselves too clean. Someday, in the not-too-distant future, your doctor or an immunology specialist may actually suggest that you swallow some eggs from a hookworm or a whipworm. And yes, both of these are nematodes. This line of thought led to the following exchange with Byron and Adler.
Well, what could be more obvious than that cleanliness is next to godliness? I mean,
it turns out that's from your mom and not from God. There's a whole discipline of evolutionary biology that focuses on evolutionary medicine. If you understand the environments and the selection pressures that kind of drove the way we came to be, then we'll better be able to diagnose and treat the diseases, the proclivities, the susceptibilities that we have. We've co-evolved with these parasites for millions of years, with these pathogens, parasites, you know, bacterial things that are in our environment. And now, like that, someone tried to get us to believe that cleanliness is next to godliness. They were talking about your room, Eric, but they weren't talking about like making sterile bodies, because when we try and get rid of our old friends, we call them our old friends, these parasites have been with us for millions of years. And when we start getting rid of them, because we're all amped up about our hygiene, when we pull ourselves out of that natural system, when we remove the bacteria, when we remove the pathogens and the parasites, now our immune systems don't have anything to do, right? And so the energy that's typically allocated to our immune system is still there, but the things that they're supposed to combat isn't. And so then that sends our immune system into this like haywire, right? They don't have to, you know, the immune system gets confused, it doesn't function correctly, and it turns against ourselves in many cases. And so this hygiene hypothesis or this old friends hypothesis is implicated in a lot of autoimmune disorders.
You teach parasitology, is that right, Adler?
I do. I've taught it for 9 years. It's a wonderful class. I learn something every time I teach it.
When did you first become aware that a hookworm could be a good thing in a human?
It was actually as I was preparing to teach this parasitology class, I was introduced to the wonderful world of helminths as therapeutics.
Quick aside here, the nomenclature is a bit confusing. Helminths aren't a species or class of worm. For some reason, any parasitic worm is known as a helminth. Many nematodes are helminths and vice versa. And some flatworms and flukes wriggle into the helminth box as well. But the whipworms and hookworms, on which much of this medical research currently centers, are both helminths and nematodes. And so with that somewhat straightened out, let's go back to Adler Dillmann.
And there is a growing body of research looking at the potential benefits of helminth therapy. So intentionally infecting people with parasitic helminths to mitigate autoimmune disorders and immune systems that are inappropriately regulated.
Nowhere in your PhD studies did anyone tell you that helminths are actually good for your health.
No, but there was an NPR study that I use in my class. NPR did a story on it in 2008, and they're referencing a case of a businessman in the Bay Area who intentionally infected himself with a nematode, and then they allowed these researchers to kind of follow what was going on with him. He had ulcerative colitis. And when I listened to that story on NPR, I read the primary research article it was based on, and I was fascinated.
So do you know what nematode it was that he infected himself with?
Trichuris trichura. It's commonly called whipworm. This is a parasitic nematode that lives in the large intestine. It's actually quite prevalent. We estimate there may be 800 million people on planet Earth that are currently infected with that parasite. So he wanted to infect himself, and he spoke with the primary researcher and said, look, I'm going to do this anyway. I know you guys can't do it for me, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to order some eggs. I think he ordered them from someone in Thailand. And now that you bring it up, it could have been Trichuris trichura or Trichuris suis, which is the pig version. I can't remember exactly, but it was one of the two. And he ordered eggs from this researcher, took those eggs, and allowed the scientists at UCSF to then study him, take biopsies, look at the pathology in his intestine, and they saw the symptoms of his disease basically go away.
So in this case, the helminth worked. And if you know anything about chronic autoimmune disorders, you know how remarkable that is. And by the way, with my disclaimer that we do not offer medical advice here on Constant Wonder, Adler-Dillman told me that with these particular worms, there is little risk of getting stuck with a helminth long term.
Over the years, it came back when the parasites died. He reinfected himself. As far as I know, he might still be infected. Trichuris doesn't last for very long, maybe a few years, three or four, in a human before they die. With parasitic worms, it's unusual that you can get them replicating and staying in the same host. Usually for parasitic worms, when they mate, all the progeny go out. They're excreted. Right. So you only have the initial infectious load. Then it just gets excreted. It's in the large intestine. It just gets pooped out when it dies.
Signs proven wrong, minds blown, assumptions shattered, species discovered. In this field, as in so many others, the more you learn, the more you realize how little you know. And that can make you feel quite small, set against the infinitude of life and the grand scheme of the universe. And so I'd like to conclude with a few thoughts from Byron Adams about feeling small, a theme that surfaces repeatedly on Constant Wonder. There is a widely noted link between the sensation of vastness combined with the feeling of smallness in the face of that vastness and the awe and wonder that we seek on this show. So here with the last word is Byron Adams.
It's really common for me to be someplace in the landscape where I really am almost overcome with a sense of wonder and awe for either how complex or amazing or beautiful whatever it is that I'm experiencing or seeing. And I always had trouble articulating that. And then once I was in Antarctica and there was a film crew there that was making a movie, and I was talking with one of the cameramen. And the cameraman was like, you know, almost weeping. And I was like, hey, what's up, Mo? And he's like, it's not common that I get to feel small in a place like this. Like a lot of humans, like we spend our whole lives trying to get to a place where we feel small. And I'm like, what are you talking about, man? Like you have worked all over the entire planet. Like every continent, every ecosystem, he's really the super accomplished guy, right? And he's like, yeah. Like, it's almost like my mission is like my search. I'm a seeker, and I seek for these opportunities where I can feel small. And these are people that they're obviously not religious, maybe, but they're trying to describe something that I would say is an element of the spiritual or the intangible or some aspect, right, of our lives that's outside of the easily demonstrable. And when we were having that conversation, I was totally connecting with it. I was like, oh, yeah, because there's so many times when I feel small, and that feeling of feeling small, like, just opens me up to all these other feelings that come rushing in that provide meaning in my life, right, that I derive a lot of meaning from. And so it's true. I think as humans, we do seek for those types of experiences. And so I will have those kinds of experiences, whether I'm with my team in Antarctica and it's been a long day and we've just accomplished some great science, or I might be, you know, looking at a worm like underneath a microscope and just and seeing it do something in its environment, right? It creates a spark. There's this new idea that I have or something like that. Maybe figuring out something that was unknown or something that was complex, or putting something together, putting the pieces together of a puzzle, and now you see it in context of a bigger whole. And those kinds of moments, I think, are, I attribute those to the spiritual, right? The otherwise difficult to explain, like as a scientist part of things, difficult to explain.
Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. Our guests today were Byron Adams, a biology professor at BYU, Adler Dillman, a nematologist at UC Riverside, and Michael Werner, a biological sciences professor at the University of Utah. The Plant Parasitic Nematode Songbook was written by Kathy Merrifield. Singing her lyrics were Brian Tanner, Becca Hurley, and Sam Payne. Today's episode was produced by me, with help from Elaine Scott and Audrey Hughes, and with sound design by Josh Fouts. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.